The Nordic countries have a pretty impressive reputation globally for their efforts to achieve carbon neutrality when it comes to energy production and consumption. And they're also perceived as pretty great when it comes to public transport and bicycle use too, of course. But as they push on towards highly ambitious carbon neutral targets nationally, the Nordic countries are going to have to get even more creative when it comes to green transport. And I don't just mean splashing out on lots of shiny new Teslas. I'm looking at you, Oslo residents. We're talking about some of those higher-hanging green transport fruit, if you like. We've teamed up with the Nordic Council of Ministers for 5 special editions of the Foreign Desk Explainer, delving deeper into topics of global importance from the region: political cooperation, education, cultural collaboration, biodiversity and protecting nature, and the subject of this episode, green transport. How fast will you be able to travel from Oslo to Stockholm by train in the future? How can a 7,000-ton car ferry recharge its batteries in 12 minutes? And how close are we to battery-powered planes? I'm Michael Booth, and this is the Foreign Desk Explainer.
Yeah, let's say equal to maybe 70 Teslas.
We had actually a sleeping car from Oslo to Moscow, by the way. Hungarian Railways, we ran a train actually from Malmö down to the Adriatic in Bar.
We're a very active participant in the Nordic Electric Aviation Group, where we're looking at both the aircraft and the infrastructure needed for electric aviation.
That was Anne Laurilahti of Finnair talking about the rather exciting progress being made with electric planes. More on that later. For the past 20 years or so, it had become almost ridiculously cheap to fly short-haul in Europe, to dash from Helsinki to Nice for the weekend, or take a quick business trip from Copenhagen to Stockholm, there and back in a day. And domestic flights within the Nordic countries have boomed too. This all came at the cost of long-distance train travel in the Nordic region, and further out into Europe, with those services being reduced and, in some cases, cut altogether. Ah, the romance of the night train, gone forever. Or is it? All those short flights were never terribly climate-friendly, and they certainly don't help the Nordics' attempts to meet, and in some cases exceed, their Paris Agreement CO2 reduction goals. Denmark is aiming to cut emissions by 70% within the next 9 years, for instance. But even before the pandemic, there were signs that the long-distance train routes might be experiencing a revival. The Swedes were already leading the way, thanks in part to the urging of teen climate activist Greta Thunberg. The number of flights Swedes were taking was already declining, albeit slightly, and there was a surge in interest in long-distance train travel there, including internationally, to the other countries in the region and Europe. We'll hear about how the Swedes went crazy for European train travel a little later. Meanwhile, another form of transport which has long been central to the way of life in the Nordic region are its ferries, another not terribly clean way to travel which is also experiencing a green makeover. Battery-driven ferries seem an improbable development given the sheer scale of the challenge, but they are already a reality here in the north. My name is Michael Booth. I'm Monocle's man in Denmark and the author of a book about the Nordic region, The Almost Nearly Perfect People. For this special edition of the Foreign Desk Explainer in association with the Nordic Council of Ministers, we're going to be looking at how the Nordics are travelling greener, or at least trying their best. Later, we'll be hearing about aviation and those long-distance trains. But we start with the sea. The ferry route from Helsingør in Denmark to Helsingborg in Sweden is iconic in this part of the world. It sails 150 times a day from right beside Hamlet's castle on the Danish side over to Sweden. This was the first high-frequency ferry route in the world to go electric, at least one using large ferries that can take trucks and cars. 4Sea Ferries, which runs the route, started converting their 4 ships to lithium-ion batteries in 2018. 2 have already been converted, and the rest will be within the coming years. I met the CEO, Christian Durhus, who we'll hear from in a little while, and went along to take a ride. As you can hear in these first seconds of my report, I exhibited my total ignorance of maritime terminology in discussion first with the chief engineer, Christian Andersen.
Thank you. So now we're up on the roof, or rather, this is the deck.
We've got a ship,
deck 7, yeah.
And this is where the batteries are, right?
Yeah, that's correct. Here's the batteries. We have four containers with about 4.1 megawatts storable power. Yeah, that's equal to maybe 70 Teslas.
Right.
And we use about the same amount of power in one crossing that a normal household uses for 1 month.
It's quite warm in here. Is that because of what's happening inside these large grey cabinets?
Yeah. These converters, they makes a lot of energy heat, and all that heat that is cooled down with water, and that's what I said before, we take that energy in the cooling water and send it down to the engine room and run our heat recovery pumps, and by that we are carbon free.
And do you have any sense of how long each of these batteries will last, how many years?
Well, the financial lifetime is supposed to be, that's our budget is 5 years, but so far what we have seen when we have done our state of health measurements, we think we can run them 7 years.
So and any idea of what they cost to replace?
They cost about 2 million euros for one ship. We think maybe that the investment will be, the payback of the investment will be somewhere about 6 to 7 years or something like that.
Captain, hi, or so this is the bridge.
This is the captain and chief mate.
With an amazing, as you'd expect, panoramic view through the smoke glass, and hoving into view just across the water is a Hamlet's castle, Kronborg.
Yes, we are basically sailing between the two castles which the Danes used to collect toll from all the different countries that were sailing in and out of the Baltic Sea.
As you can see now, we're running in battery mode. We could push the hybrid button and that will start one, two or three generators depending on how much we need to charge the batteries and also supply the power, necessary power for the propellers. And then we could change over to hybrid. And of course, we still have the old diesel mode to go over to also. And it takes about 45 seconds to change over between the different modes.
So it's just three little buttons.
Yeah.
I expected, you know, great big levers and pulleys and, you know, steam would go off. But they're not even prominently placed. They're just at the back of the whole control panel here. Anyone passing by can just say, oh, let's switch to hybrid.
Change mode, yeah.
It is our goal as a company to be able to operate the complete company, ferries and harbours and administration, everything, with a usage of less than 1,000 tonnes of CO2 per year. We came from 36,000 tons per year before we started with the electricity on the ferries. We slashed it from 36,000 to 13,000 when we introduced electricity on the two main ferries we were sailing most of the time. So it's a 65% reduction approximately that we managed there. When we install electricity on all our four ferries, we will have a reduction of about 97%.
All right, now we're just coming into the dock and the bow door is rising up above us, and over on the right hand side there's that tower with the a glass tower with the robot arm inside. It looks a bit like the kind of robots they use to build cars or something like that.
Exactly, it's actually a ABB standard industrial robot that has been converted for marine use and a harsh environment that will now soon detect. We can go over here and we can see now it starts up, it lights up and opens the roll up.
Oh yeah, the roll up door is coming up and the robot arm is springing into action, and now it's plugging into the side of the boat.
Yeah, it's charging.
That was in a matter of seconds
it's
that happened.
It's really fast, yeah.
How much does it cost, one charge?
I think it is 240.
Yeah. So 240 kroner per crossing on electricity.
Yeah.
We did the change basically because we want to live up to the world goals of being climate friendly and so on. We also did it because we hoped that on the long term there would be a business case.
How much did it cost?
The total cost of changing it was 300 million Swedish for two ships.
At what point will it break even and make economic sense?
It will break even in less than 20 years, and then you can say less than 20 years, that sounds like a long time, but ships generally sail 40 years, 50 years, so it's actually okay. But the primary driver was not economics. The primary driver was to be climate friendly.
Has it affected ticket prices?
No, not at all. We have kept the same ticket prices. In the future, we will convert all our ships to electricity, and then at some point of time, it will probably be a combination of electricity and hydrogen.
What do you see as the potential for this technology globally?
I think that all short-haul ferry routes will be on electricity inside not so many years.
That was Christian Durhus of 4C Ferries talking to me about the electric ferry from Denmark to Sweden. To Norway now. We've looked before at Oslo's shift to electric cars in a previous Nordic Council of Ministers foreign desk. In this programme, it's the turn of the trains, particularly the international train links from Oslo to Sweden and beyond. I spoke down the line to Norwegian Transport Minister Knut Arild Hareide about his government's plans to get that inter-capital city journey time down to less than 3 hours, and also about Norway's historic tendency to spend big on roads, but not quite so much on trains.
So we are now building a lot around Oslo. We call it the intercity work in three directions from Oslo. But of course, we want to focus more on also the across national borders railways. And we want to start a study between Oslo and Stockholm. That will be also perhaps some private initiative, how we can make a better line between Oslo and Stockholm. And there is some plans that we can perhaps have only, it costs 2.55. That means that we'll use 2 hours and 55 minutes from Oslo to Stockholm. That is the first work we want to do. We are also working with the ERTMS. This is the system, and it's in the railways in Norway, but that will be very important for us, and will be easier to also be part of the borders outside of the railway outside Norway. There's also an ongoing electrification of the Meråker line, and that will provide a fully electrified train connection between central Norway and central Sweden. So I said we are working in three lines from Oslo, and the Østfold line is one of that. And that is the line that goes from Oslo to Gothenburg. But I think we will be finished to Oslo-Fredrikstad around in the national plan we have launched for the in the parliament, actually handled by the parliament in next week.
Help me to understand some of the figures about the current transport plan in Norway, because I see 36 billion is allocated to roads, and only 30 billion allocated to railway development. But I'm wondering, is that a reflection of the political makeup in Norway, which has leaned centre-right in the past few years? Or is it just a reflection of the geography of the country?
I think it's more the geography than the reflection of the government. I was a chairman of the Transport Committee 10 years ago. We then used, I'm talking about Norwegian crowns, around 8 billion for the railways, and we used around 20 billions for the roads 10 years ago. Now we have doubled the investment for the roads, but we have gone from 8 to 33 billions to the railways. The budget is close to 33 billion. So when we see how many people in Norway are using the roads and how many people are using the railways, we should invest lots more in the roads and than in the railway we are doing. So most of the people in Norway, they are not even close to a railway in their daily life. Of course, a lot of people around Oslo have it, but in the rural district in Norway, it's the road you have to use. And in some parts of it, it's actually also, we say that the planes are the public transport for most of the people in Norway. So I think we are, to be honest with you, I think I've started as minister 1.5 years ago, and I was increasing the budget with around 6 billion crowns to the railways because of how our country look alike, the geography, and we are really, I would say we are 6 to 8% of the traveling in Norway is with railway, and 80 to 90% of the traveling at the roads.
I understand that you're going to be, the Norwegian government is coming out with a new hydrogen plan. I just wonder, is there anything you can tell us with regard to the hydrogen plan and transport?
In September, I think they will start with the first hydrogen ferry in Rogaland. And we have also had a bid for a new ferry in North, where we want hydrogen power. And so there will be 2 ferries in Norway with hydrogen power. And that has been very important so we can establish a market of hydrogen.
That was Norwegian Transport Minister Knut Arild Hareide. Just over the border, Norway's neighbours, the Swedes, have embraced train travel much more enthusiastically, particularly when it comes to international journeys. Perhaps the Greta Thunberg effect at work. Trans-European train travel was once really popular with the Nordic people, but then came the budget airlines and the long-distance night trains down through Germany to the ski resorts in winter and to southern France and Spain in summer slowly declined. As COVID hopefully retreats and people start travelling internationally again, that decline could be about to reverse. Correspondent Richard Orange went, by train of course, to meet one Swedish travel agent who's been working on behalf of the increasing number of Swedes who want to abandon air travel and travel longer distances by train to reduce their carbon emissions. Not least, Thunberg herself.
I'm on my way to visit Ivar Karlsson, who runs a little-known specialist rail travel agency in the Swedish port town of Kalmar. Or at least it was little known until a few years back, when the 70-year-old and his team arranged an epic train journey across Europe for the environmentalist Greta Thunberg. Carlson used to run part of the international division of Sweden's National Rail Company, so he's perhaps the perfect person to ask whether after the pandemic, Sweden is about to enter another golden age of international rail.
Hello.
Hello,
Richard.
Hello. Welcome to Kalmar.
Yes. Carlson's office is actually the ticket office at the city's train station.
So you use the same ticket office as Kalmar?
Yes. All is handled because we sell local tickets and we sell normal rail tickets within Sweden and we sell international rail tickets, which is really a rarity.
One of his staff, Maria, is on the phone sorting out a summer trip for a new customer.
Since 1 year ago, it like stopped. It was almost dead, but now it starts again, I think. People are mailing us or calling us and want to start travel abroad again.
Sweden's flygskam, or flight shame movement, led tens of thousands of Swedes to cut their carbon emissions by ditching flights to Thailand or the Mediterranean and instead take the train through Europe.
It took off in 2018, and then we had about 100% increase. In 2019 it was 60% even more, but then we just knocked into a roof. We couldn't cope with it actually. We tried to, but for only 24 hours a day, so to say.
Why was it that Sweden was one of the first countries where this demand to not fly really took off?
First, it was a lucky coincidence. At one time, we have Greta, we have Björn Ferry, which is a famous man in Sweden. And
he's a skier, yeah.
Yeah. But actually, I think it has something also to do with Swedes' interest of nature. And then this effect in Sweden, you know, we say we are a small country. It's difficult to have more than one opinion at the same time here. So people just starting moving in one direction. It's just like a snowball effect, so to say. It is a big phenomena, but it is not the mainstream behavior, but it is moving in that direction.
You arranged the tickets for Greta Thunberg on her big Europe tour. Is that right? I don't know how many tickets you've arranged for her.
Well, I cannot go into details about that, but we made them, yes, we arranged them.
It wasn't the first time Carlson had witnessed a golden age of rail tourism. In the early 90s, Swedes hit the tracks en masse to tour the former Eastern Bloc countries.
We had actually an enormous volume, and it all really started up in 1990 when the wall was torn down. Things really started to move. December 89 was quite enormous. Mm-hmm. And then from spring 1990, we had quite extreme traffic. It worked well because there was a good international cooperation, which I was also part in for many years. We had actually a sleeping car from Oslo to Moscow, by the way. Hungarian railways, we ran a train actually from Malmö down to the Adriatic in Bar.
How optimistic are you now that after the pandemic is over, that the revival of international rail traffic might continue?
I'm rather optimistic because the engagement for the environment is still there. The Greta effect among the kids are enormous. And then, of course, also a lot of people had experienced good journeys before the pandemic, and now they have been sitting at home dreaming about a revival of this, and that means that there is a lot of possible expansions very quickly, I would say. If all works out well, I think 2022 will be a very great year, and that's also the year when we see the first of the new Austrian night trains coming.
Thank you, Richard. We're going to finish in Finland, which has some of the most ambitious emission reduction targets in the world. The government has pledged to achieve carbon neutrality by 2035, and in particular, to reduce transport emissions by half by 2030. Monocle's Helsinki correspondent, Petri Burtsov, met up with Finland's Minister for Environment, Krista Mikkonen, who began by outlining how the government plans to meet those lofty goals.
We are including biogas and electric fuels in the distribution obligation, and then we are having support for public charging and gas filling station, and also support for housing companies and workplaces for charging infrastructure. So that helps people to choose an electric car or the gas biogas car, and then and those are the things that replace the fossil fuels, and then some. Measures to renew the vehicle stock is that we have a procurement support for the fully electric cars, and we also have a tax reduction if you get electric cars as company cars, and then we have a conversion support for ethanol and gas vehicles, so you can convert your old car to the gas or ethanol car.
Finland's size and sparse population present particular challenges for the greening of the country's transport sector. The use of public transport is common in larger cities, but in the sparsely populated rural areas, personal vehicles are still widely used.
There's many areas that the public transport is can't work, so we need those kind of measures that how we reduce the emissions from the personal cars, and also that is there some measures we can do that you don't need to move everywhere, that we have this kind of for example, now after the corona time, there's a lot of discussion that could we work more at homes, so you don't have to move every day to your working place.
You mentioned that a lot of the journeys below 5 kilometers are still made by cars, and you as the government would like people to make those journeys more with public transportation and bikes. I'm wondering, what can you do to encourage people to ditch the car for that 2 kilometer journey and hop on a bike or even just walk?
That's a good question. First of all, you need to make sure that these cycling and walking lines are nice, that it's safe to bike or walk. And then also I think that city planning has a very important role. When you are doing the city planning, you really should think that how to make it easy to use bicycles or walk for the short distances, especially inside the cities.
Finland's long and cold winters are not ideal to get people biking or walking over long distances or to switch to electric cars with their limited range.
Many people think that electric vehicles do not have the range and reliability need for the harsh winter conditions and long distances. And although the technology is evolving all the time, and I think that's more that people need to have like a first-hand experiences on that, that really that works. But there's a lot of thinking that is it possible. And also I think the sparse population has limits to the public transport. So in those cities where we can do it, we really need to do it. But there's a lot of areas that there's just not such much people that you can really have a public transport. So we also need that kind of measures that how you can reduce your own emissions of your own car. So we need different kind of measures, not only the public transport, but the whole set of the different measures. And I think that's very important to understand when we are talking about the transport sector in Finland.
That was Monocle's Helsinki correspondent Petri Bertsov talking to the Finnish Transport Minister, Krista Mikkonen. We're staying in Finland because the national carrier, Finnair, is aiming to cut its CO2 emissions by 50% by 2025 and become entirely carbon neutral by 2045. Petri went along to Helsinki Airport to hear from Finnair's head of sustainability, Anne Larilahti, about the airline's goals and how electric planes, which seem such a science fiction concept, are actually closer to reality than many of us may realise.
Yes, we are looking into it. We're a very active participant in the Nordic Electric Aviation Group, where we're looking at both the aircraft and the infrastructure needed for electric aviation. We also written a letter of interest with a company called Heart, a Swedish company that is building an electric 19-seater aircraft.
Do you have any sort of goals or targets or dreams about when it would be possible to start actually flying electric?
We'll see. It's still a little bit in the future, but Heart Aviation is planning to fly commercially already in 2026. Another really important part, and this is where I'm really excited about, is that you need to build a standard for electric aviation, so that when you fly your electric aircraft from one airfield to another, you can actually charge it there. And the standard is the same and the plug is the same. You know how you go to the US and your phone doesn't charge because you can't plug it in. So we need to avoid this. And Nordic Electric Aviation Group is working on creating a standard that would be a Nordic standard to start with, and then we can maybe roll it out in the world like we did with mobile phones. There's a lot of progress on electric flying across the world because everybody sees it as very, very interesting way to travel in the future. I think we were talking about flying cars when I was a kid, but it's not really flying cars, but it is electric airplanes that are getting smaller and smaller. So there might be sort of this urban electric flying very, very soon already. Then we're going to see a little bit bigger airplanes, such as the 19-seater that we're in discussions in, and that is then for the short-haul flights, maybe domestic flying, maybe Helsinki-Tallinn, that type of routes. But then on the long haul, still flying from Europe to Asia, that's still going to be traditional airplanes for still dozens of years.
That was Monocle's Helsinki correspondent Petri Bertsov talking to Anne Larilahti of Finnair. That's all for this week's special episode of the Foreign Desk Explainer, produced by me, Michael Booth, in association with the Nordic Council of Ministers. It was edited by the team at Monocle 24 in London. Thanks for listening and goodbye.